Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaca. Last week's episode was a pretty lighthearted one about love and Valentine's Day, and so we thought we'd do a complete 180 on you and talk about sadness and grief. Feeling sad is something that any human can relate to, so there are plenty of stories in place for this week's episode of Real College Podcast, which starts right now. Explaining in a meaningful way suicide and depression to a child is an impossibly hard task. Explaining the suicide of a family member is a step beyond that. In this story, a mother peels back the layers of repressed memories and trauma to tell the sensitive story of her father's death to her son for the first time. Nathan Fervoy has the story.
So, do you want to know, like, a little bit about your grandfather?
Yeah, that would be good.
Okay.
I know, like, little bits, but I don't know a whole lot.
Okay. Well, where to start? So,
when I first speak with my mom, I don't know where to start. I have, in my head, a vague outline of my grandfather. His name was Irv. Brown hair. He was a singer. Highland Park. Owned a laundromat. When I was young, I was told that he had been sick, but that he would have loved me very much had he been here. When I was nearing high school, I was told suicide, that my mom had been just 16.
And that was his first passion, and I have lots of recordings of him.
I talked to my mom to fill in the details around the life and death of my grandfather. Details which a knot of trauma has kept repressed for all these years.
He was just a really fun person. Yeah. Start there about that.
Is that when he started running the laundromat?
As we speak, certain details start to be strung together. My grandpa, a singer, suddenly thrust into running a business with two small kids at home.
Her father, so this would be your other grandfather, or great-grandfather, my grandfather, owned a bunch of dry cleaning plants. I guess my dad ended up just kind of taking over without having any experience, and it was just kind of fell into his lap, and I honestly don't think he was ready for that or really wanted that. So that's kind of how that started. If you can imagine this, my parents would drive to the west side of Chicago 6 days a week. They had to be there at 7 a.m., and they worked till 7 p.m., 6 days a week. It was hard work. You know, it was stepping away from his artistic world to take care of his family. This, again, comes up for me whenever I speak about him because, again, like, if all you knew about your grandfather is that he committed suicide, I don't feel like it's doing, you know, it's... rewarding who he was, because he was so much more than that. There was a fire.
A fire at the business, starting his decline. His hair going white. A last walk with my mom, and a horrible phone call the next morning. While painful, I realized that the specifics of his death are nowhere as important as what came after. How my mom and grandmother were able to cope and go on with their lives.
They just felt so sick and strange, and everything seemed gross and weird. And I ended up sleeping in Bobby's bed. And I think I was more worried about her. I guess this is the thing that was really sad to me too, but it made total sense for me at the time. Was like I felt really guilty that it wasn't me who died. Like I had wished it was me and not my dad, because I felt so bad for my mom. And to this day, I still think it was worse for her than for me. I mean, it was different. It was a different loss for each of us, but, you know, my life was sort of just beginning. And so, I don't know. And after that, there's a funeral, and it was a strange parade of friends and family coming through and sort of giving you weird pep talks, and yeah. Nobody knows what to say to you. I mean, I can tell you awful, weird, you know, like, well, I had an uncle who basically said, don't tell anybody what happened for insurance purposes. There wasn't much more than just survival at that point.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. Like, I don't know, what would be the healthy way to deal with that?
Right.
I'm not sure. I mean, we did go for therapy. I hated it. I hated it. She dragged me. But I went because I thought she needed to talk. You know, Bobby talked about it nonstop.
Yeah?
Nonstop. She'd be on the phone all the time.
Yeah.
And I hated it. I didn't want to talk about it. I just wanted to kind of go on with my life and be normal. Isn't that, like, every kid just wants to be normal, I think.
Right.
And that, and Bobby was always a talker.
Yeah.
She was.
Yeah.
And, you know, that helped her process all of it. If anything, maybe, probably would have made sense for me to talk more about it. At that point, but I wasn't ready.
Talking.
Yeah.
Putting thoughts out into the world to be acknowledged by others and then moved on from.
You can't really talk to.
But for an experience as jarring and isolating as a parent committing suicide, how can a kid share their feelings with those around them? How could another kid know how to empathize or discuss something so unimaginable, something most adults would struggle with? In high school, trying to be normal, maybe it was easier to not talk about something so taboo.
It's a horribly uncomfortable thing to talk about, and it's hard to know how to be a friend.
Easier not to talk with my brothers and I either. Kids without the emotional depth needed to comprehend.
I think it's more acceptable now to talk about it than it was 30 years ago. I think so, and I think that's good.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I think honesty is really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think as I get older, I want to be able to talk about it just openly, like, yeah, this is what happened to my dad. It's odd. It's a strange thing to have to tell your kids. It makes me sad that he didn't know you. It makes me sad that he just took a moment in time of madness and ended it all without any faith that things could get better. You know, not to like sugarcoat it or anything. It is something that happened. It is something that, you know, is in the past. I was able to move on and have a good life. You know, that's amazing to me. You know, it's a tragedy. I mean, if anything, Nathan, like, you can move on from crises and tragedies. You can move on and have a good life. I do.
are you now? Now that I need you so, lover, where are you tonight? Are you alone?
It can be hard for caring adults to know how to talk to children about death. There's sometimes the idea that children should be protected from knowing about grief and loss, and there's uncertainty about just how much a child can handle. These questions become pressing when someone who is integral to a child's life dies. Liv Riggin sat down with Jenny Simon, Director of Youth Grief Services at Fairview Health, to learn about how children process grief and how those close to them can help.
The really bittersweet experience for the families to walk through the doors, and they look around and see, you know, 60 other people there, and they're really relieved that they're not alone, and also like sad that there's all these other people who are experiencing such profound loss.
That's Jenny Simmons, the program director at Fairview Clinic's Youth Grief Services. She's describing what it's like when families get to Camp Erin, the camp she runs for children dealing with grief and loss. It's a free program run by Fairview that includes 7 weeks of therapy plus these two large group weekend events that run as summer camps for the kids. Because kids may not articulate their feelings in the same way adults do, recognizing that they're grieving and helping them articulate it is a big step.
A lot of times the kids won't go to their parents to talk, and the parents will come, they'll say, you know, they talked to me about everything before. They were good sharers, they shared their feelings, and since their mom's death, for example, they won't talk about mom or they won't talk about it. And we just could say, well, that's because they know that you're hurting too right now. And so when you bring up mom, they know that that makes you sad and it's okay to express that, but they just kind of made their parents sad, which is really hard. We often change the language if they say, if my child's grieving, or if this child is grieving, and we say, how is their child grieving? And again, every day is not a bad day for a grieving kid. They can really be in the here and now and be enjoying life, and at the same time have a lot of mixed feelings inside, a lot of worry. They can have a lot of guilt. There can be nothing that they had anything to do with the death, and they still can feel guilty.
Grief can manifest in a variety of ways depending on the age and the personality of the individual kid.
It depends a bit on the chronological age and developmental stage. Typically, younger kids, their grief or loss of a loved one can really manifest itself in physical ways, playing a lot of stomach aches or headaches. What a parent might see is then the child comes home and just has a complete meltdown or has an outrage of anger and doesn't know that what's going on with that really strong, intense emotion. And sometimes kids can articulate that they're missing dad, for example, if their dad died, but a lot of times they can't really articulate that. Having some separation anxiety is huge for all ages of kids. And they may not articulate this, but they're really afraid that another loved one, like their other parent, might die. Again, they might not ask their parent about that, but they're thinking it. I can guarantee you, with all the families that I work with and all the kids that I've worked with over the years, the kids are worried about that. And so to really educate parents, to have that conversation with them, that you're not putting it in their head, they're already wondering that and worried about that.
Depending on the kid, they may also want to know more or less information about the death than their parents expect.
Some kids want to know a lot. Every single detail around that cancer, for example, I want to know exactly how it hit the body. I want to know what cells were there, what medications. And the sibling that's, you know, right next to him might want to know hardly anything about it. Yep, I know dad died of cancer. I'm good to go. Like, I don't need to know anything more. So that's, again, another tricky part is that it has to do with, you know, personalities, and some kids have higher anxiety, so don't want too much information. Some have a strong threshold for wanting to know lots and lots of information, but death is a part of life, and it's surprising how many times kids really do want to talk about it. a big piece of it is educating adults that kids can need truthful information and that they can handle it. And it's age-appropriate but truthful information. So, you know, we deal with complicated losses such as loss by suicide or homicide, overdose, and we really believe that kids can handle that conversation and they need to know the truth. If they don't, they'll likely find out later on, and then they have to regrieve that, and they'll have lots of times of bitterness or anger at the person that they trusted the most who didn't tell them the truth. And we understand that the intentions of that, you know, that parent to tell them what they told them is just out of love, but it's really important that they do have those conversations that are truthful.
Group therapy sessions can be an especially good way to talk about death. It lets kids describe what they're feeling without feeling like they're adding to their parents' emotional burden, and it also lets them know that they're not alone. There's other kids who are feeling like this too.
So really normalizing feelings. I think one of the things that's the most helpful with the kids that we work with is that we don't do one-on-one work with a therapist one-on-one. We think that going to a therapist is great, but there's really something that's really, really transformative and healing when kids are able to connect with other kids their age who knows what it's like. There is such a before and after in their life, and they're just trying to manage how to get through the day and this grief-laden home and just trying to figure it out. And so it is so important that they have an outlet to be able to be like, oh, me too, you know. Over the years doing this for over 10 years, I think it is the power of them connecting with one another or holding a space for them to connect with one another. And they do the magic. The kids do that with one another. And when they're finally in a room with other kids and they're a 10-year-old girl saying, I really miss my mom because, you know, she was in Girl Scouts with me before and now she's not in Girl Scouts anymore. And I feel left out. You know, if she were to tell her dad that, he would have an emotional reaction for good reason. But in this room that, you know, around other 10, 11-year-old girls, she can say that, and the kids around the room are just nodding their head because they have a story similar to that. They, too, miss their mom doing this or that with them or their dad doing this or that. So they have a general understanding, even though the stories are so different. So that's what I think is really, really important, is to get kids connected with other kids. If anybody knows of a family or experienced loss where there's children in the home, to get connected and get resources for them.
I'm Leigh Friggins for Radio K's Real College Podcast. Death is probably one of the things that causes the most grief, fear, and anxiety for people. Because death is such a mystery to people, they often seek help getting through it. And that help can come in all sorts of places that you might not expect. Alex Schumacher has a story about dealing with death and the sadness that comes with it.
I had one that the guy had died, and his wife was just inconsolable. I mean, they'd been together for a long, long time. And he was coming back early in the morning, like at 4 a.m, and sitting on her bed. Well, she could feel the bed go down, and it was scaring her to death. And so they came to see me, and I convinced him, not a good idea. You know, I know you really want to comfort her, but you're scaring her terribly, because she'd feel like somebody was in the room with her, and it was just him.
That's Reverend Kathy Wilkin, and as you might have already guessed, her approach to death and the dead is not what one would call the traditional Christian one. Rather, Kathy is a tarot card reader and a medium who spends part of her time helping the grieving and also the dying understand what comes next. And before we go any farther, let's just pause for a second and all get on the same page about what tarot is. If your only knowledge about tarot comes from TV or popular culture in general, Your opinion on it might be that tarot is a cure-all or just a bunch of magic cards, but as any tarot card reader will tell you, that's not the case. As Sam Lofgren, a tarot card reader who considers themselves a specialist in death, explained to me, tarot is all about being a mirror. That means showing people options and, as Sam explained, in the case of death, accepting hard truths.
If you come to me with a question about death, and death shows up in the spread, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to die tomorrow. But they are going to die. And so a lot of it is just looking at what's to be learned of this. You change the nature of the question. The question isn't whether or not they're going to die. The question is, how can we let them do that with as much grace and dignity as possible? What do I need to know to help them go? What do they need to know? And so you start looking at where the lessons are, where the heart is of the matter, rather than the facts of the matter. If they're in hospice, that's where we're headed, that's where we are. And a lot of it is just accepting that fact. And sometimes I've had entire spreads for family, especially for family members and close friends, where the guts of it is, honey, you have to accept. I know you don't like it, but you have to accept it or you're gonna hurt somebody, generally themselves.
And having to accept difficult truths is one of the things readers find tarot is most helpful for. Rather than providing one answer, as Sam explains, tarot can help shape a conversation about death and how to accept it.
Being able to help shape that transition to something with more grace and dignity for them, for whomever is dying, for the community in general, honestly, depending on who it is really more what the cards are good for, because at that point you don't go into it with a yes or no sort of question. You go into it to find how you feel about it, where you should go with it, how to handle it best, rather than do you do it at all.
And when death is inevitable, both Sam and Kathy help people accept what's happening and be able to move on with less fear about what comes next.
It's interesting how many people are afraid to die because they're afraid of being judged. And part of what I do is I also do mediumship, which is talking to people on the other side. And I can honestly tell them I have never talked to anybody on the other side who said, oh, that judgment, that was really terrible. You know, not one person has ever told me that. My dad was dying. He really wanted to know, what do I see? What do people say to me? When they're dying and when they're gone, you know, what does that look like? And he'd really come around because he truly, probably in the last 3 years of his life, embraced the work I do. And he I think was one of those people that was afraid of being judged. And he finally decided, I don't think I have to worry about that. And I'm like, I don't think you do, Dad.
From Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher.
Creativity comes from a lot of different places. The most common connection tends to be between sadness and creativity. Real College Podcast reporter Sachin Mangalik talked to a few creative types about how emotions play a role in their art.
Hello. Today, we will be looking at creativity and sadness.
Yeah, that song is pretty creepy. So, yeah. I hate to say it, but I feel like so many of the most creative people have trouble with themselves. Maybe the most famous example is Vincent Van Gogh, or as my art teacher used to call him, Van Gogh. And he's got a pretty terrible story. He shot himself in the stomach. And yet, today, he's one of the most influential artists of any time. And he's not the only one. David Foster Wallace was an incredible writer who took his own life. There's, of course, Robin Williams, who took his own life. Ernest Hemingway, another example comes to mind. What is it with these people? Is there truly some hint of sadness that is so intense that it creates some of the most incredible art, but also some of the most destructive people?
Personally, like, when I'm sad, I'm more creative just because I get more work done.
That's Tara. She's been playing piano for a pretty long time.
There's more opportunities for me to have creative ideas since I'm working on things more. When I'm sad, it's like I want to distract myself.
There's definitely an element of discipline involved. Vincent van Gogh didn't start painting until very late into his career. But when he did start painting, he painted a ton.
Like, I was watching this interview with Sam Smith, and he was talking about how he wrote over 200 songs for his newest album.
But then there's also a clear element of emotion. A lot of the strongest art best captures human emotion.
He was like, oh yeah, I tried to write some happy songs, and they were just, like, horrible. And so that's why he always ends up with sad songs.
And maybe the emotion that we relate to most clearly is sadness.
People still cry, even if it's, like, happy tears.
Yeah.
There's something associated with beauty that's, like, sad. Like, if something's beautiful, you still cry.
Although I do think emotions are definitely, like, at the forefront of creativity.
That's Jack. He's been a musician for a pretty long time.
Especially when you play, like, with people, like, play music with people. Because, like, you can communicate with the other people that you're playing with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, like, one of the most satisfying parts of it. And it's always sad when you're done with that, I think. You hear a lot about, like, mental illness in people that are in the arts.
I don't necessarily know if it's the art that's causing the sadness or if it's the sadness that's causing the art, you know?
Yeah.
I don't really know which one affects which.
This woman, Nancy Andreessen, she conducted a study in the late 1980s where she basically interviewed a bunch of writers, and she found that 80% of them had been hospitalized for some mental illness like bipolar disorder or depression. This is something I talked to Tara about. So, is there some sort of correlation between the arts and there being more mental illnesses?
Face value, there seems like there is, but also it could just be the industry. You know, like, in arts, it's much more okay to openly say, like, hey, I'm depressed.
I also talked to Jack about it.
I guess just the fact that you hear a lot about, like, mental illness in people that are in the arts, I guess. So I always hear that a lot.
Yeah, I think there's definitely this idea of not a starving artist, but, like, the tragic artist. Or
anxious, depressed, eccentric. I actually think that might be, like, a symptom of, like, having artists kind of have emotions at their surface more so.
I think artists are able to wallow in it more.
Yeah.
And I think that's unhealthy. Because if that's what's making them successful, why change?
Special thanks to Tara Karki, Jack Perner, and bensound.com.
That is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. We are funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We're produced by Alex Schumacher, Emily Allen, and Liv Riggins. I'm your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening, and make sure you tune in every Monday at 6:30 for more arts and cultural coverage.